Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As Tuesday's presidential debate was wrapping up, the moderators finally asked a question about the climate crisis.
We have another issue that we'd like to get to that's important for a number of Americans, in particular younger voters, and that's climate change. President Trump, with regard to the environment, you say that we have to have clean air and clean water. Vice President Harris, you call climate change an existential threat. The question to you both tonight is, what would you do to fight climate change? And Vice President Harris, we'll start with you. 1 minute for you each.
Well, the former president had said the climate change is a hoax. And what we know is that it is very real. You ask anyone who lives in a state who has experienced these extreme weather occurrences, who now is either being denied home insurance or it's being jacked up. You ask anybody who has been the victim of what that means in terms of losing their home, having nowhere to go. We know that we can actually deal with this issue. The young people of America care deeply about this issue. And I am proud that as vice president over the last 4 years, we have invested $1 trillion in a clean energy economy while we have also increased domestic gas production to historic levels. We have created over 800,000 new manufacturing jobs while I have been vice president. We have invested in clean energy to the point that we are opening up factories around the world. Donald Trump said he was going to create manufacturing jobs. He lost manufacturing jobs. And I'm also proud to have the endorsement of the United Auto Workers and Sean Fain, who also know that part of building a clean energy economy includes investing in American-made products, American automobiles. It includes growing what we can do around American manufacturing and opening up auto plants, not closing them like happened under Donald Trump.
Vice President Harris, thank you.
That didn't happen under Donald Trump. Let me just tell you, they lost 10,000 manufacturing jobs this last month. It's going, they're all leaving. They're building big auto plants in Mexico, in many cases owned by China. They're building these massive plants and they think they're going to sell their cars into the United States because of these people. What they have given to China is unbelievable. But we're not going to let that. We'll put tariffs on those cars so they can't come into our country, because they will kill the United Auto Workers and any auto worker, whether it's in Detroit or South Carolina or any other place. What they've done to business and manufacturing in this country is horrible. We have nothing because they refuse. You know, Biden doesn't go after people because supposedly China paid him millions of dollars. He's afraid to do it. Between him and his son, they get all this money from Ukraine. They get all this money from all of these different countries. And then you wonder, why is he so loyal to this one, that one, Ukraine, China? Why is he? Why did he get $3.5 million from the mayor of Moscow's wife? Why did she pay him $3.5 million? This is a crooked administration, and they're selling our country down the tubes.
President Trump, thank you.
If Donald Trump goes back to the White House, it is game over for the climate at the federal level. In May, the Washington Post ran a piece called What Trump Promised Oil CEOs as he asked them to steer $1 billion to his campaign. Trump has pledged to scrap President Biden's policies on electric vehicles and wind energy, as well as other initiatives opposed by the fossil fuel industry. Climate scientists like Dr. Kimberly Nicholas say in order to stabilize the climate at any temperature, we have to completely stop adding carbon to the atmosphere. If we want to cut global carbon emissions about in half by 2030 and zero by around 2040, we have a 2 in 3 chance to stabilize warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius. The next president is crucial for the climate crisis. Joining us to talk about all of this is Jeff Dembicki, a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSMOG. That's a global news organization that works to provide climate accountability and serve as an antidote to science denial and disinformation. Jeff Dembicki grew up in Alberta, Canada, near the tar sands. He's author of The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. He studied hundreds of confidential industry documents, first-hand accounts and reports revealing how some of the world's largest oil companies have ignored warnings about climate devastation since as early as 1959. Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
Well, it's great to have you. First off, can you talk about what is at stake in this election around the climate crisis?
I mean, basically, the United States has ignored increasingly escalating warnings about climate change for decades now. I mean, really, we should have been taking action on this back in the late 1980s when James Hansen first raised the alarm to Congress. And now we're at a point where climate disasters are impossible to ignore. And the truly terrifying thing is that we're just at the very beginning of a period of increasing planetary chaos and destabilization. And so these are really kind of the crucial years right now when the United States could provide leadership on the issue and start to get global emissions under control. That's why this election is so crucial for the future of the climate and the planet.
I go back to what I said in the intro, the year 2030 is so crucial. So many climate scientists say that we have to cut global carbon emissions in half by 2030, which is not far from now. And that is why this next president will determine whether we take action on the climate or not. Jeff, why do you think this is not getting the attention it deserves? I do want to mention that Bill McKibben had a piece in The Guardian just a few days ago called "If Trump Wins the Election, It Will Doom Our Efforts to Slow Climate Disaster." He writes, "Donald Trump gets everything wrong about global heating. The results of the vote in November could reverberate for a million years." Why aren't we hearing more about this?
I mean, this is kind of the question that everyone who's involved in the climate change space is asking all the time. And it was central to that film, Don't Look Up, that came out a few years ago. Climate change is such a, you know, massive existential threat that sort of challenges everything we've kind of assumed about how society works and economic progress, that it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around what it all means. And so I think a lot of people, rather than engaging with this big scary thing, would prefer to tune it out. And we're seeing our elected officials kind of pander to that impulse. But there's another aspect to this, which is that for the first time in a long time, the United States is actually taking a little bit of leadership on the issue. And for all his climate flaws, Biden responded to activist pressure and helped bring in this Inflation Reduction Act, which has steered hundreds of billions of dollars towards clean energy and at least put the United States within sort of like squinting distance of getting towards the reductions we need to see. And that progress isn't really recognized or talked about or acknowledged by a lot of people in the country, which I also find quite strange.
This is a good point. And I also wonder why we don't hear about the fact that that bill would have gone much further when you think about the original version of Build Back Better, where frontline communities and environmental justice advocates supported that bill because it was so ambitious. And yet Senator Joe Manchin completely diluted it. It became a completely different bill. He took out so many of the climate provisions. Joe Biden said he supported the original version of the bill, but it just hardly gets talked about.
The crucial thing to recognize with Joe Manchin's opposition to Build Back Better, which you're totally right, would have been a much more aggressive version of what we're currently seeing, is that Joe Manchin was essentially a proxy for the oil and gas industry. An Exxon lobbyist bragged at one point that he had meetings with Joe Manchin just about every week. And when Build Back Better was first laid out, the oil and gas industry, they ran just an absolute flurry of ads all across the country saying Build Back Better was going to destroy the economy, take away jobs. It's kind of amazing even that the Inflation Reduction Act squeaked out amidst all of that.
And if we can talk about policies here, I mean, we heard there Trump's has nothing to offer on the climate crisis. So his answer is not that surprising, but we do need to talk about what would happen if he won in November. I mean, meeting with oil executives and basically telling them, give me $1 billion and I'll give you exactly what you want. I'll get rid of Biden's climate policies. I mean, that's what Project 2025 lays out. What would happen, Jeff, if someone like Trump were to enter the White House again, given that we just don't have time to tackle the climate crisis? It's not like we can say, well, in 4 more years, we'll figure something out.
There was a study that was reported on in The Guardian a couple weeks ago that actually tried to quantify the negative impact that Project 2025 would have on the climate. And the researchers estimated that if all of these reactionary policies were implemented, it could result in an additional nearly 3 billion tons of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere by 2030. And that would essentially make it impossible for the United States to achieve its climate targets. But what that would also do is sort of demoralize the entire global push towards dealing with the climate emergency, because the US in a lot of ways sets the global agenda for this. It's not the only player, but it's a very important player. But I also want to point out that even though the Biden administration has significantly increased its spending on clean energy, Biden also oversaw a massive expansion of the American liquefied natural gas industry to the point where the U.S. is now the largest LNG exporter on the planet. And Biden also oversaw the U.S. maintaining its role as the largest oil producer, bigger than Russia and Saudi Arabia. So it's kind of mind-blowing to think that the U.S. is pulling more oil out of the ground than these places that we consider to be like the petrostates in the world. And so that just shows how convoluted all of this is at a moment when we really need like clarity and certainty in dealing with this crisis.
Exactly. And that's why I wish that climate change played a more prominent role during the debate rather than one question toward the very end. E&E News has a piece called Harris Embraces U.S. Fossil Fuels in Showdown with Trump. Harris praised U.S. oil and gas production during the presidential debate, a move meant to fend off Republican criticism of her climate agenda, but one that's likely to anger environmentalists backing her candidacy. So you just have to wonder, is Harris going to go down the same path as Biden when it comes to oil drilling?
It does kind of seem that way based on her remarks during the debate. And, you know, I want to point out there is a difference between Trump and Harris. Trump has called climate change a hoax, and he subscribes to some of the more like hardcore climate change denial that we've seen come up again and again for decades. But there is an extent to which Kamala Harris is also engaging in a form of climate delusion. And it's this idea that we can take steps to grow clean energy while also overseeing a massive LNG industry and oil industry in America. And really, that's just not consistent with the science. We need policies that really address the supply of fossil fuels, that put caps on production, and that start to wind down the industry immediately. And to say otherwise really goes against the science on climate change.
The media have spent a lot of time asking Kamala Harris why she changed her views on fracking. And the Will Bunch with the Philadelphia Inquirer had a piece about fracking and where people in Pennsylvania stand. And he wrote, "Here is the truth from someone who actually lives in Pennsylvania. Most folks, especially in areas like Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and their suburbs, where many voters reside, don't really talk about fracking, certainly not as much as the big issues like the economy or abortion rights. And when we do discuss it, many Pennsylvanians, perhaps even a majority, oppose fracking because we don't want to prolong the climate climate destruction of fossil fuels, or because folks who live near these fracking pads are sick of the smell, the noise, and the threat to their health. So you just have to wonder what her strategy here is by saying she now opposes banning fracking, but not really elaborating on that. And then we have to also acknowledge how the media works, because they want her in a gotcha moment for sure. But you just wonder what she's thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what she's thinking also, because I've spent time reporting in Southwest Pennsylvania in some counties that are considered, you know, the most fracked places in America. And in some of these areas, it's rural farmland and people have well pads, you know, literally in their backyard. They're breathing this polluted air. People have rare cancers. It's polluting the local streams where people fish. And some of this is taking place in areas where the politics have leaned quite conservative. And there's a lot of anxiety around this industry and the effects it's having on people. I'm not so sure that Kamala Harris bragging that fracking is increasing to record levels and that she no longer opposes a ban on the industry is as popular with all of these independent or swing voters as she likes to think it is.
Today, we're spending the hour with Jeff Dembicki, a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSmog. We're talking about his piece, Inside the Anti-Climate Culture War, led by Jordan Peterson and Project 2025. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so I'm sorry we cannot take your phone calls. Going back to what is at stake in this election when it comes to the climate, again, Jeff, I think it's so important to point out that we just don't have time. I mean, if Trump gets in there from 2025 to 2029, and we've got to take this action by 2030, we just don't have the time to continue down this path, as he says, bringing back the drill, baby, drill.
Yeah, we absolutely don't have the time. We don't have the time to even, you know, make incremental progress, let alone reverse progress that's been made. And you know, the good thing is, despite all the convoluted policies and the conservative opposition and the oil and gas lobbying and basically every obstruction tactic that defenders of the current fossil fuel system have thrown in the way of progress, the U.S. is actually moving towards the type of emissions reductions that we need to see by 2030. It's still a ways off, but you could imagine a scenario where a president puts in place clear restrictions on the production of oil and gas, winds down the industry, and continues to accelerate spending on clean energy all across the country. And that could actually result in a lot of non-linear progressive progress towards the type of future that we need to see.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that, Jeff? What is happening out there when it comes to progress that we're not hearing about?
Well, the main impact of the Biden administration on climate, as we were discussing, was the passage of this Inflation Reduction Act. And that basically has directed hundreds of billions of dollars towards clean energy manufacturing and the rollout of things like solar and wind all across the country. One of the interesting things about this process is that a lot of the funding and the infrastructure build out has gone to Republican states. Mm. And it's a lot of it is taking place in rural areas. And so we're not necessarily seeing stories about this in the national media, and it's certainly not informing a lot of the debates that take place each day in politics. Even in some of these areas, people are benefiting from new factories that are, for example, manufacturing wind turbine blades. But it's not necessarily clear for people even living in the areas benefiting from this policy that it's due to a Democratic administration. And I know in Georgia, for example, the governor has tried to take some of the credit for this spending, even though he opposed it while it was being debated.
Well, to your point, I saw a piece about Texas A couple days ago, out of Axios, Texas passed California as the state with the most power generating capacity from big solar projects. And then Axios also has a piece about how the Biden administration is spending $7 billion on rural electric cooperatives to boost renewable power, to nearing finalization of a new marine sanctuary in the last week alone. And again, Trump has vowed to just undo all of that. Last week's announcements included $100 million from the bipartisan infrastructure and climate laws to hone extreme weather and climate forecasting at NOAA, and $300 million from the EPA for greenhouse gas emission reductions in tribal communities. In addition, the White House touted more wind energy investments, bringing total offshore wind power approvals to about 15 gigawatts. The EPA touted new spending on cleaning up brownfield sites. There was also a species delisting, the Apache trout, from the Endangered Species Act. So these are the kinds of things that are so important to talk about, Jeff. But they're just not sexy during an election campaign.
Yeah, and I mean, I was in West Texas earlier this spring on a reporting project, and as I was driving, I just saw wind turbines stretched out to the horizon in every direction. It looked kind of surreal and like it was almost like an AI generation or something. There were so many of them. And it's ironic because one of Trump's main talking points is how he wants to bring manufacturing back to the United States. And this clean energy spending that we're seeing is taking steps towards doing that. And Trump wants to reverse all of it. I think that tension kind of speaks to the larger challenge that a lot of Republicans and conservatives find themselves in when trying to formulate what their approach to climate change is going to be. Because on the one hand, it's clear to people all over the country that the weather's getting weird, climate disasters are increasing. And on the other hand, a lot of these rural and also Republican areas are benefiting from new climate and manufacturing jobs. And so Republicans can't just say, we're going to destroy all of this and reverse all of that. I mean, I guess Trump is to an extent, but within Republicans and among conservatives, there's now this effort to figure out, like, how do we respond to all the facts on the ground in a way that doesn't alienate people who might be part of our base?
Right, exactly. I mean, as we're talking, there are wildfires burning in California, Nevada, and Oregon. There was a record-breaking heat wave in Southern California. So we're just breaking records on a regular basis. We're definitely going to do a show about what is happening with the IRA. And Axios points out that Biden's legacy on climate and energy policy depends in part on the administration's ability to funnel billions of dollars out the door, along with regulatory steps during the next 4 months. So these details are so important, and we will definitely do shows about this. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Jeff Dembicki, a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSMOG. That's a global news organization that works to provide climate accountability and serve as an antidote to science denial and disinformation. Jeff is the author of The Petroleum Papers: Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. When we come back, we'll talk about his latest piece, Inside the Anti-Climate Culture War, led by Jordan Peterson and Project 2025. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about media coverage of the presidential debate and what's at stake. Donald Trump's racist and dangerous comments about Haitians eating pets in Springfield, Ohio, is getting nonstop attention. What about the real-life consequences of what he is saying? We'll also talk about why Democrats have allowed Republicans to frame immigration. Today, we are spending the hour with Jeff Dembicki, a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSMOG, a global news organization that works to provide climate accountability and serve as an antidote to science denial and disinformation. Jeff Dembicki grew up in Alberta, Canada, near the tar sands, and he's the author of The Petroleum Papers: Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. He studied hundreds of industry documents and reports revealing how some of the world's major oil companies have ignored warnings about climate devastation since as early as 1959. And this is a pre-taped conversation, so I'm sorry we cannot take your phone calls. So, Jeff, let's dive in and talk about your latest piece called Inside the Anti-Climate Culture War, led by Jordan Peterson and Project 2025. The Canadian influencer and his allies in the U.S. religious right want people to see climate action as a pseudo-religion. You went to two Jordan Peterson arena shows and found documents linking him to Project 2025 and billionaire frackers. This was a five-month investigation, and you found that climate is fast becoming the next front in the religious rights culture war. So first off, who is Jordan Peterson?
Jordan Peterson is from Canada, and specifically, he's from Alberta, the same province I'm from. And he actually grew up only a few hour drive from where I grew up. And so I've always had kind of a special interest in him and watching him sort of become this global conservative influencer. He was a professor at the University of Toronto for a long time, and he really exploded into the culture wars when he refused to use the pronouns of some of his students. This was a few years ago, and that led to a backlash, and then it led to Peterson being celebrated by large portions of the online right in America and around the world. And since then, he's kind of become this global far-right celebrity influencer. He's currently one of the main stars of the Daily Wire. It's this right-wing media outlet created by Ben Shapiro and a fracking billionaire from Texas. Peterson, over the past couple years, has really started to make climate denial and climate obstruction a key part of his message. He has a podcast that reaches millions of people. It's one of the most popular podcasts in America. And he's used that to bring on all sorts of climate deniers and people with ties to the oil and gas industry. I spent a lot of time listening to these episodes and attending Jordan Peterson events and just trying to track the impact he's had in the world, because I think what's happening in Jordan Peterson's orbit is the development of this anti-climate conservative message that can address some of the tensions we were discussing before the break, namely that climate change is happening, people see it, and conservatives need a way to talk about it while still seeming legitimate.
I was just checking his social media accounts to see how much influence he has. As you said, millions of people listen to his podcast. On Twitter, he's got 5.5 million followers. On Instagram, he has 8.6 million followers. For people listening right now, and I often think about this a lot, do I really want to spend my time reading about these people? Because there's so much going on right now. So why is it important to pay attention to and learn about people like Jordan Peterson?
I think it's important because within the conversations that Jordan Peterson is having in public on his podcast and within the in-person events that Peterson is organizing with prominent conservatives and also U.S. Republicans, there's this effort to really debate and create the conservative ideas that then end up filtering into actual policy or statements by prominent conservative politicians. I sort of think of it as this big conservative idea stew, and then every once in a while this like burp of gas comes out of it, and then that starts informing policy. And Jordan Peterson, as you pointed out, has a massive social media following, and that essentially has allowed him to create his own like independent media ecosystem. Based on the number of followers that he has, he's able to reach more people online than a lot of legacy media. And I think people should be concerned and pay attention because a large proportion of the people that are following influencers like Jordan Peterson are under the age of 40, and a lot of them are teenagers. And so these really reactionary anti-climate messages that he's putting out to his followers are starting to inform the thinking of the next generation of conservatives in America and around the world.
So tell us, what are some of the main statements he's trying to get out there? You quote him, he did not respond to a detailed list of questions from you, but you do quote him. And he talks about how we're in a culture war right now. This war was started because the idea that we can lead moral lives and build a just society based solely on scientific facts turned out to be wrong. What is he telling his millions of followers? And we should also say that you start your piece. I didn't realize he was doing these stadium tours, but you start your piece talking about how people bought tickets, $95 tickets at the Dickies Arena in Fort Worth, Texas. And then in April, he actually sold out Radio City Music Hall in New York City.
Yeah, I was surprised at the level of in-person popularity at these events. I mean, Jordan Peterson is rarely ever covered anymore in establishment media, but he, in some ways, he's more popular than ever. And these were huge, passionate crowds at the show in New York at Radio City Music Hall, for example. A week and a half before Peterson spoke there, the venue hosted Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and Bill Clinton. And at the show in Fort Worth, one of the MCs pointed out that this arena had also hosted Justin Timberlake. And so these are like major events that are nearing, like pop culture levels of popularity, and yet that's sort of rarely reflected in a lot of the media reporting. And so I think what Jordan Peterson is really trying to do right now on climate change is he can see that this is becoming more and more of a prominent issue, and it's becoming more mainstream and more people are talking about it. And so he's trying to develop a way to link a conservative anti-climate argument to already existing culture war issues that are really resonant with conservatives. And so one way that Peterson does that is he started to make climate change about questions of population control. And so he says anyone on the left who cares about climate, ultimately they want to limit the population of the planet. And he talks about younger people, millennials, for example, deciding not to have children because they're so scared about the future that climate change could bring. And so Peterson links that to already existing religious right talking points about the decline of traditional families, fears that young people aren't reproducing, and kind of this, unspoken message that if America and other developed countries don't reproduce their populations, then they're going to be overrun by immigrants.
You talk about the influence he has, especially with young people. And you write that when the Center for Countering Digital Hate commissioned a survey of 13 to 17-year-olds in the United States about, quote, new denial narratives pushed online by people like Jordan Peterson, over one third agreed that the impacts of global warming are beneficial or harmless. Teenage boys, in particular, seemed more likely to hold extreme views. 45% of male respondents to the survey thought climate scientists are manipulating data, and 41% agreed climate change is a hoax to control and oppress people. What stood out for you when you interviewed people about why they listen to Jordan Peterson or why they would go to these events? I mean, you interviewed one person who told you that for years he's listened to his podcast while stuck in traffic.
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of the thing that I've tried to figure out is how can someone with such a reactionary nihilistic message on climate change in some ways appeal to so many people. And I think one of the things that we sort of underestimate about the right sometimes is its ability to tell what sounds like a really optimistic, inspiring, hopeful message to people. And what I mean by that is a lot of the stuff that Jordan Peterson talks about in his books and at the sold out shows is sort of repackaged self-help advice. It says to people, you know, you may be struggling in your life, you may be facing these challenges, you may not be where you want to be, but with extreme discipline and by taking full responsibility for your choices, you can be successful, you can transform yourself. And that's sort of like, you know, bedrock conservative thinking, but Peterson sort of packages it in a new and exciting way. And he starts to extend that thinking to climate change in his podcast episodes. So he says, you know, you may have heard that the climate is in peril, the planet is in crisis. That's not actually true. We have the opportunity to create the most flourishing, amazing world in existence. And we'll do that by helping lift the developing world out of poverty with fossil fuels and nuclear energy. And I think where Peterson and other conservatives and even people like Trump can start to gain real traction when talking about this stuff, even though a lot of their points are like factually ridiculous, is they sort of like aim their attacks not necessarily against climate change and the events that are happening on the ground, but against the climate activists and advocates and policymakers who think it's a big deal. And there's this effort to sort of, you know, demonize climate activists as these irrational people following a pseudo religion. They're probably, you know, secretly Marxist, and we definitely shouldn't be letting them tell us how to live our lives.
Today, we're spending the hour with Jeff Dembicki, a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSmog. We're talking about his piece, Inside the Anti-Climate Culture War, led by Jordan Peterson and Project 2025. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so I'm sorry we cannot take your phone calls. Jeff, you followed the money here. Jordan Peterson surrounds himself with, again, very influential people. You write about his billionaire backers. So tell us more about what you found there.
So Peterson, a few years ago, joined the right-wing media outlet, The Daily Wire. And The Daily Wire right now is one of the most prominent conservative media brands in the world. And what's really interesting is if you go back a few years, that site was actually founded with a few million dollars from this fracking billionaire in Texas named Ferris Wilkes. And so Ferris Wilkes, it's actually quite a strange story. He grew up in this tiny town called Cisco in Texas. I actually visited it last spring, and it's not the place that you would expect, you know, a billionaire conservative like media founder to come from. And for most of his life, Ferris Wilkes has been involved with this church founded by his father called the Assembly of Yahweh. And it's this sort of like strange blend of Christianity and Judaism. They celebrate Passover, and they also believe the Bible is like true and correct in every historical detail. And so in the 2000s, Wilkes started this fracking company called Fractech, and that was just as the gas industry was really starting to take off in the United States. And so in 2012, Wilkes and his brother sold their fracking company and made $3.5 billion. And then he started making all these investments in conservative like culture war causes. And Wilkes was eventually introduced to Ben Shapiro and Jeremy Boring and this guy Caleb Robinson, and together they launched the Daily Wire. And this fracking billionaire Wilkes is still a co-owner of the site. And that's kind of significant information to me because the Daily Wire now hosts Jordan Peterson's podcast, and a good deal of his podcast episodes are aimed at demonizing climate activists, saying that global warming isn't actually that big a deal, attacking scientists. And all the while, this is being published by an outlet that's owned by this really far-right religious fracking billionaire.
And can you talk more about the you talk about Prager University in your piece also, but toward the end, you write about this new educational venture called Peterson Academy. And its professors include Jonathan Pigou, a YouTuber who has characterized fears about climate change as, quote, secular apocalypticism. Another professor, the podcaster and author Michael Malice, claims that projections of sea level rise are literally a religious belief. And when you go over to the Peterson Academy website, it says that they've got professors from Harvard, Cambridge, Stanford, McGill, Columbia. They're providing, quote, profound and practical knowledge in humanities, finance, health, fitness, science, and more. So tell us more about this Peterson Academy.
So Jordan Peterson, like a lot of conservatives, they have a really big distrust of higher education. They sort of see it as this factory for, mass producing young liberals. And so Peterson launched this thing called Peterson Academy, actually just this week. And it's claiming to be an alternative to traditional university, and so you can pay the tuition fee and then take online lectures from a whole range of sort of conservative and contrarian thinkers. And then if you choose, you can do assignments and get them graded by some sort of artificial intelligence program. And it's important to point out that the school hasn't been certified, so no degree that anyone gets from this will be actually recognized. So essentially, it's a glorified, expensive YouTube session where you just watch these contrarian people rail against climate action and any other sort of, progressive policy, and this is all sort of framed as free, independent, nonpartisan thinking. And so this kind of gets to what we were talking about earlier about how these types of right-wing influencers are really going after sort of younger people who haven't fully formed their political identities yet. And if you can reach people when they're like 18, 19, 20, then a lot of these beliefs will stick with them for the rest of their life.
Wow, this is so interesting because we talk a lot about how the media ecosystem has changed so much over the years. And it's rare to think about how this is affecting young people, especially young men. So I think what you're talking about here, Jeff, is so important. And just to give people a sense of what they're doing with this Peterson Academy, you've got introduction to nutrition, intro to psychology, symbolism and Christianity, intelligence, rationality, wisdom and spirituality, intro to neuroscience, intro to cosmology, the economics of human flourishing. So what do you think, Jeff? What is this? I guess, what don't we understand about this new media environment and how people like Jordan Peterson, they might not be in, he might not be in our world at all, but he is influencing a lot of young people, especially young men. So how should we be thinking about that and talking about the effects of that?
I mean, that's a really good question. It's definitely true that these conservative spaces, they exist independently to a lot of media spaces that you might exist in if you're like an NPR listener, or you don't live in an area where all of this is especially resonant. And I think what I'm coming to appreciate is that a lot of conservative influencers have sort of constructed these closed information ecosystems that can reach, millions and millions of people, and arguably are more influential and have higher levels of audience than a lot of establishment media these days. And I think that sort of coincided with this inability to sort of provide a vision of the world that's appealing to younger people, or especially young men. And I mean, they're watching all our politics, and they're seeing the hypocrisies play out in our leadership, and they're looking for answers and someone who can come along and present what feels like a really strong and forceful vision of what a good life looks like, and make it seem like it's filled with, philosophical inquiry and wonder. That's appealing to a lot of people. And I also want to point out that a lot of Jordan Peterson's influence isn't only taking place online. Increasingly, he's moved into more direct political organizing. He organized an event in London last year called the ARC Conference, and conservatives from all over the world came there and hung out, including Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. He was a speaker there, Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. And the Heritage Foundation, which was the group that created Project 2025, they were working behind the scenes to invite as many Republicans and spouses as they could to Jordan Peterson's event. So you have this online influence and then real-world political influence.
And at that event, Prager floated the question of whether Antarctica is melting.
Yeah, it seems kind of ridiculous, but at an invite-only session during the ARC conference, which I learned about through this recap of the night that was posted on this conservative Australian think tank blog. Basically, there's this room full of people. They're eating dinner in a panel with Jordan Peterson, Dennis Prager, this guy Alex Epstein, who's a fossil fuel consultant and author, this guy Michael Schellenberger, and they're all debating this question: is Antarctica melting? Which seems totally ridiculous, and no one can really seem to offer a good answer to that. But I think it shows you how conservatives are trying to grapple with this unavoidable climate reality that we're all facing, and try to come up with some sort of response to it. Because to a majority of the Earth's population, it's very clear that the polar ice caps are melting. And so conservatives all the way up to Trump are trying to figure out, like, okay, what do we do with that information, and how do we turn it into policy?
Well, and to fact check that, there are so many articles out, Scientific American, Antarctica's Doomsday Glacier is melting even faster than climate scientists expected. Antarctic and Southern Ocean Coalition, not only is Antarctic ice melting more quickly than new snow can replace it, but the rate of loss due to melting and calving is increasing. Jeff, we're out of time. This went by so fast. Final thoughts on what you found here and why you think this is important to talk about?
I think big picture points, the future president, if that's Kamala Harris, needs some sort of strategy to phase out and wind down fossil fuels. Like, there's just no way to achieve any kind of lasting climate progress without getting rid of the fuels that are at the heart of the crisis. And I think at the same time, there needs to be this effort to bring all sorts of people who are currently outside of the climate conversation into this massive, you know, generational historical effort to get the climate under control. And as part of that, there's an opportunity to take all of these young people, especially angry young men who are really upset with the political system, upset with the hypocrisy of leaders, and are looking for a meaning in their lives. There's an opportunity to bring all of them into the climate fight in kind of new and interesting ways that haven't been talked about before, and to blunt the impact of these people like Jordan Peterson, who are trying to capitalize on people's discontent with the shape of the world.
Wow, it sounds like we really need to do a show about that. Jeff Dembicki is a Brooklyn-based investigative climate journalist with DSmog. He's the author of The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. We had Jeff on several times to talk about that very important book, and you can find it online, kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Jeff, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for helping to put this show together. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.